This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
I'm Matt Chulley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, what do political parties really spend their money on? Some amazing research looking at every single item that money was spent on during the 2019 general election. Is it all about leafleting? Is it all whiz-bang, newfangled internet things? And which party spent money on emergency chair removal? We'll find out. Before that, the columnists India Knight and James Marriott on Reform UK sacking a candidate who turned out to be dead, and India and I fall out about orchids. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. But first, as we always do on Politics Without the Boring Bits on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned that a Reform UK candidate who was dropped due to doing nothing in an election year had a good excuse. He was, in fact, dead. Reform UK leader Richard Tice had this helpful advice for candidates who are actually alive.
For heaven's sake, you know, if you're going to have a glass on a Friday night, then don't use social media. It's not sensible.
Yeah, it happened to all of us after a long week. You pour a massive rosé and you become a massive racist. We learned that there was one thing that Rishi Sunak is very sorry about.
Well, first of all, I have to issue a fulsome apology to the Samba community.
Although he also needs to apologise to Louise.
Let's go to the next call. Louise is in the Rhondda Valley and you're through to the Prime Minister. Go ahead, Louise. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Hi, Rhondda.
We learned how Peter Mandelson spends his free time.
I have to say that the only bed I've ever bounced up and down on with a famous person was Elton John's.
What?
In France. And for some reason, Thomas the Tank Engine videos were on the TV.
We learned that Keir Starmer, who usually can't stop going on about being a lawyer, suddenly isn't very interested in one particular case.
Andrew Rayner has been asked no end of questions about this. I don't need to see the legal advice. My team has seen it.
We learned about Ed Vasey's youthful foray into publishing.
We did actually. I started a magazine with Michael Gove. First of all, it's called Blue. And we published one edition. We got David Cameron to write an article. He couldn't think of anything to write about because he doesn't have much thought about policy. So just write what it's like to be the candidate for Whitney. We then discovered after we'd published it, shared its title with an Australian gay porn mag. So we had to cancel that.
Crazy. Top quality coffee content, coffee break content. I think he's back next week, so he's going to be in next week for more. The other thing, of course, we learned this week is that my new friends at Youth Demand, who protested outside Keir Starmer's house, very, very happy for me to just pop round to theirs.
Please do. I'll put on the kettle.
And that is what we learned this week. Now, it's these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott. India Knight and James Marriott.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor of my laptop, frantically battering away at my column.
We say hello to India Knight. Hello, India Knight.
Matt, I like your jacket.
Thanks very much. It's from a sort of Friday, you know, burnt orange jacket.
It's very nice.
Well, yeah, thanks so much. And James Marriott's here. James, how are you?
I'm good.
You are a pioneer of the shacket, aren't you? You have them in all shades.
I don't think I'm a pioneer. I think I came to them quite late.
I can't see many other people wearing them.
that's the opposite of being a pioneer.
Yeah, everyone's rapidly abandoning the shacket.
To the shacket what Rishi Sunak has done to the Samba trainer? That is the big question. Now, I want to start off by talking about Reform UK. They're obviously polling, they've got ahead. They're polling ahead of the Tories in some areas. They're neck and neck across the country in the polls, but it does mean they're getting more attention on them. 10 of their candidates have now been removed for posting racist, sexist or homophobic things online. And then yesterday, we got news of Tommy Corkwell, who was an RNLI volunteer, who was the party's candidate in York Central. And the party dropped him due to inactivity. They said, we cannot afford to have people doing nothing in an election year. And it later emerged that the reason Tommy Corkwell hadn't done a thing as a candidate for Reform UK is he was dead and the party didn't know, but they'd publicly slagged him off regardless. India, for those of us with longer memories, it's all very reminiscent of UKIP. But what's weird is it's all the same people involved. You know, it's Nigel Farage is involved in Reform UK. I think the chairman of the party used to be chairman of UKIP. The press people, the people. In fact, I think the guy who said why they were dropping the dead man used to do press for UKIP. They just never quite sort of seem to learn their lesson.
No, I think what this story shows, which is very funny, apart from for the family of the man in question, I think what this story really shows is that Reform, like UKIP before it, is a very successful, in one way, pressure group with interests in different parts of the country. But really what this story shows is that they aren't, like UKIP, in my view, a proper political party. They haven't got the wherewithal and the resources and the gumption and the people to function properly, because a political party that functioned properly would never have happened, obviously, or very rarely have happened, not have happened like over 10 times.
And James, if in the run-up to an election they're supposed to be taking all these votes off the Tories, which they currently are, but they just can't seem to get their act together, so that instead of taking the fight to the Tories, Richard Tice ended up giving a press conference this week where he's asked repeatedly about all these things, and his solution was to tell people not to drink and tweet on a Friday night. Because obviously, when you've had a drink, you end up being a bit racist.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. I guess the challenge for the Tories is to make them seem completely ridiculous and discredit them. I do tend to agree with what India says. They're a pressure group. People, I don't think, were ever particularly thinking they were voting for Reform UK because they thought they were a ruthless party machine that was going to, scythe its way into government and manage the economy brilliantly. It's a protest vote. And unless this really becomes a completely overwhelming narrative that it's just this sort of ludicrous, incompetent clown car, and I wonder how many people that's, really reached so far, I think, does this stuff harm them? I don't think people are thinking they're voting for an uber-organised, superbly effective political party. They're kind of registering a point of view that they feel is unrepresented in the political mainstream. And as long as they can do that, I kind of feel like, they're going to achieve. There's a kind of, their success can only sink so low.
Yeah. There's also, I went on their website. I've written my column on this for tomorrow. And I went on the first thing that happens when you go on the Reform UK website is a message coming up saying, we're verifying you're human.
And alive.
Well, that's why.
Well, they should have had that.
That's
one.
That's my payoff with the column.
Oh no!
They should be checking for a pulse. But you can go on if you want. Anyone can apply to be a candidate. You have to pay them £25.
I think we should do this sometime on this show. We should do a live application to be a Reform UK candidate.
Well, because one of the questions. Hang on. So we go on the website. We could do it now. Look. Although you're paying the £25. Oh, I've not got the thing asking me if I'm alive. Oh, well.
That's the crucial flaw.
Yeah. So there were about 20-odd questions. You'd like to be considered for a candidate. Where would you like to be considered for a candidate? Have you ever done anything that might embarrass the party? And then it says, have you ever been a member of or affiliated with any of the following? Tommy Robinson, the National Front, the British National Party, British First, English nice. Defence League, for Britain Movement or Antifa. And there's a yes or no. It's not clear whether saying yes is a help or a hindrance.
Expedites your application.
I'm not aware of any past or current issues in my background that may embarrass Reform UK or bring it into disrepute, and all that sort of thing. And then you name an address and upload a CV and all of this. And then it says, Reform UK is a broad movement reflecting all political perspectives to optimise the party's competitiveness against different oppositions in different constituencies. How would you describe your political leanings? And it's got left, centre, right, or other. And I just think, what's the other?
The mind boggles.
Extreme.
Yeah.
Like, I don't. And also, it's basically, they're basically, like you were saying, India, admitting that they are sort of everything to everyone.
Mm.
So if they're standing against Labour, they'll do a righty sort of person, or standing against the Tories, I don't really know.
I do have to wonder how many centrists are applying to join Reform UK. It'll be interesting to see whether your application comes back successfully before the show ends. That's a real sign that automatically verified.
It's quite a lot of questions to try and work through now. Are you tempted, India?
Not particularly, but I'm quite keen for you to do it and see where you get.
I can't do it in my actual name, though, because they'll know immediately. Or maybe they won't mind. I mean, most of their current candidates are all on GB News, so maybe they're happy to have bought.
Yeah, you've got a media presence. You're halfway there. You've got a media presence already.
Yeah. All right, we'll get on to that. Maybe I should do it on my phone. Not if I'm a child, though, because apparently the government is looking to ban smartphones for children. They're not really going to do this, though, are they, India?
I feel the horse has bolted so far away from the stable. The horse is in another continent, in another galaxy.
And the stable's burnt down.
And the stable's burnt down and the village no longer exists. I mean, you know, it's a laudable intention, but it's really, really, really late in the day. And I just don't see how. What's that man's name? Jonathan Hayter? 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 Do you know who I mean?
Yes, Jonathan Haidt. Yes.
Haidt, that's the one. I was reading a big piece about by him about his new book, which states that phones and social media have destroyed children's childhoods, basically. And I think it's true. I think they have. But what you can actually do about it at this late stage, realistically, when all the other kids in your child's class have got a mobile and are online all the time, and you take your child away. I mean, I don't see how it's possible.
If only we knew someone who'd given up their smartphone.
Yeah, well, I am not a child, but I do have a Nokia phone. I got
so how's
rid of my
it going?
Smartphone.
You've stuck with it despite the fact you've now written your piece for the magazine.
Yeah, it wasn't just a gimmick. It was a proper principle. So I've actually swapped my Nokia for one that does do WhatsApp. So, and it has Google Maps, so I can't get lost and I can be contacted, but nothing else.
You can't get on the internet?
Can't get on the internet, apart from
how
WhatsApp.
How long has it been? How long has it been now?
Ooh, a couple of months now. As I said in the piece, it's kind of fine. I mean, WhatsApp is pretty distracting. Yeah,
but it means you're not doom-scrolling social media.
Yeah, basically, it's taken me off Twitter and also just wasting my life kind of Googling, you know, random stuff that I don't really need to know.
And what have you filled this time with?
I mean, it's very hard to say this without sounding like I'm trying to be like incredibly sort of virtuous, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow-esque lifestyle influencer. But I've just read a lot more, listened to quite a lot more music, done a bit of like staring into space in a way that I think is probably not bad. I think it has made me, I think the evidence on what smartphones do to your mental health and especially the mental health of children is kind of pretty overwhelming now. And you do just slightly feel like you're inhabiting in a kind of calmer world. I don't feel like I need to know every single news story and meme and whatever's going on in the world as soon as it happens, which I was a bit addicted to. And I sort of slightly feel like I've gone into a little oasis and I can come out of my oasis and go on my laptop and, you know, see what's happening. Or read, you know, God forbid, a physical newspaper if I want to be really old-fashioned about it. And, yeah, this is slightly a happier way to live. Although I acknowledge that, you know, I'm not required to put my work emails like absolutely constantly as some people are. I don't really need any apps. Can't get Ubers, which is a bit annoying. It wouldn't work for everyone, but I think I have a job that means I can kind of get away with it.
Yeah. Well done.
Yes, thank you. I'm incredibly virtuous, is what I'm trying to say.
Now, India, this might be the first time it's ever happened. I think you and I are going to fall out.
Why?
Because you've been writing about the wonder of supermarket orchids.
Yes, I have. What, do you hate them?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you prejudiced against them? What's your problem?
They turn up uninvited in your house and then you feel obliged to keep them.
Yes. Do you hate the way they look?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you?
I do, weirdly. And I don't know why. So explain, first of all, make your case then for the supermarket orchid.
Well, But my case, I wrote about this on my Substack. My case for supermarket orchids is that they're like coming across Marilyn Monroe at the bingo. They're incredibly beautiful. They're really exotic and they're really, really cheap. And I just think it's an amazing, you know, and there they are. They're sitting there in their plastic wrapping like they were a block of cheese or a packet of mints. And they're not. They're this amazing thing. And my problem with them in the past, do you not like them because they're slightly fleshy?
I think it's their ubiquity.
They unsettle you.
And they spend, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of them not flowering in the house.
Okay. You have to water them once a week and that's it. Yeah. That's all. You run them under a tap once a week until all the water's drained out and then you put them back and then you forget about them for another week. Because I used to kill them all the time. I agree about the ubiquity, but that was kind of my point. You know, just because something is ubiquitous doesn't mean it's horrible or naff or undesirable. So I think, you know, it's nice that these orchids are turning up in your house all by themselves, Matt, by magic.
None of our friends are listening.
I think you should try and make friends with them.
Some people, Tansy says, people keep giving me supermarket orchids. I've never managed to keep one alive. I'd prefer chocolates. And then Mandy says, my sister has a collection of about 15 orchids. Assuming her to be an orchid lover, I bought her a blue orchid last year from a well-known supermarket for her birthday. She was very grumpy. Turns out, in fact, she hates orchids. And then also let me know they coloured them blue, so now she's got a pink orchid she doesn't even like. That's the problem, is that people think, oh, they've got a couple of orchids in the windowsill. I'll get them another one. No, we don't want them. But it feels bad.
I think they look nice. Cluster them all together. I think they look lovely.
What do you think, James?
I mean, I'd never thought about the issue at all in my life until this morning. But yeah, I hadn't.
Oh, my wife's now bombarding me with pictures of the bloody things that we've
got. Quite nice. I was going to say, I think because they appear in supermarkets so much, it never occurred to me that they might be like a glamorous thing, as India was saying in her Substack.
That's true.
And perhaps that's devalued them for me a bit.
That's it. Maybe it's the rethinking.
Reconceptualize the orchid. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll do that by next week, hopefully.
Let's move on. From orchids and talk about but sticking with biology. James, you've been taking part in an experiment to find out your biological age.
I have.
And?
My biological age is 62 years old. How can that possibly be true?
How old are you, James?
I'm 31. I don't think I look 62.
You don't? I mean, you look younger than 31.
You look 12.
Yeah.
Well, Times Science Editor, we need to explain it, is Tom Whipple. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
You've done this as well.
Yes.
So what is your biological age?
My real age, my chronological age is 42.
Yeah.
My apparent biological age, according to this test, is 71.
You sound really pleased about this, Tom. Explain what this test involves.
So this, I should say right away that I might not be the most impartial of describers of this. So I'm heavily motivated to think it's nonsense, obviously. The test is a measure of your immune system or a particular bit of your immune system and whether it's got these particular carbohydrates on it. So there is a lot of research that shows that with age, the pattern of carbohydrates on your, it's called glycosylation, on your antibodies, some of your antibodies, also changes, and changes in such a way that you can say that if you're 70, this is the average proportion of one kind of glycosylation to another, and use that as a way of providing some sort of clock that will show, you know, much like wrinkles, but wrinkles in your immune system, show how old you are. And they claim how old you really are, that this is something that ends up predicting your... So look, I'm enjoying the days I have left, basically.
Now, even more extraordinarily, our colleague Robert Crampton, who comes in on a Wednesday, Robert Crampton is actually 59 and his biological age is 54.
Yes, Robert, my body is a temple, Crampton.
Well, that is the problem, because he doesn't drink, does he? He does smoke.
Yeah, the day he got his test result, I actually bumped into him sitting outside a cafe in London having a fag. And I've been on a run.
India, are you tempted to take this test?
No, I hate those sorts. What is it? Is it a blood test?
Yes.
Right. No, I hate things that predict health outcomes. I mean, I don't hate them all of the time. I don't mind them in a kind of properly medical context. But no, it's just a downer, isn't it? Because you're... Robert Crampton aside, you're bound to be, you know, some sort of even more ancient than you actually are. So, no, it's just depressing. Is there anything you can do to reverse the carbohydrates on the thingies?
Well, that's, I mean, they say yes, and I think yes, but the question is actually whether this is causal. I have to say, I went to quite a few scientists on this. I went to one in particular. I went to immunologists. I went to one of the UK experts on glycosylation. I went to a guy called Venki Ramakrishnan, and I asked him, and he said, well, look, unless you look like you're dying, then it probably says more about the test than about you. And I put this to them, and the CEO of the company says, Venki Ramakrishnan knows nothing about glycobiology. This is Venki Ramakrishnan, who is a Nobel Prize winning professor of molecular biology, who has just written about the science of aging in a book. So the frustrating thing, there are many frustrating things about this. I mean, I feel like it makes great sense for James that the sort of tragedy of his life is he never got to be a consumptive poet in the 18th century. But really, he needs an early death after bad poetry and with some sort of beauty who will never, ever fall for his charms. But me, I want to live. So I want to disbelieve this, and I do say I did go for a full work insurance health MOT, which I've never done, and the doctor found it all very funny and said that I was in fine health.
Can we all get one of those to work?
We can. I never bothered because I was never worried about my health until I got this bloody test.
I think you're so right, though, India. What's the point of finding out if you can't do anything about it?
You can't do anything about it, and you just walk around feeling, you know, burdened with gloom. What's the point?
Well, because James can now, channel all that into some bad poetry. Now he's got this free time.
You made the most of me there while you've got me. I won't be here
Maybe
for long.
Maybe get tuberculosis and go and spend some time in a Swiss sanatorium.
Yeah, I'd lay off bashing away at your column, James.
That's what's aged me so rapidly.
rounding off with some final orchid news. So many people now sending in orchids. The ones that look like monkeys. Thank you, Helen. David says orchids may look gynecological, but the word orchid means testicle. So there we are.
There you go.
I think we've learned something. And then somebody else says there's only one orchid I'd have in my house, desert orchid, a magical racehorse. It's all got very weird. Louise in York says, what's a Substack? India, what's a Substack?
It's a newsletter. You go to substack.com and you can read lots of them. And mine is at indianight.substack.com.
India Knight and James Marriott, along with Tom Whipple. You can read them all in the Times and the Sunday Times with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, what do parties really spend their money on?
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
The Big Thing.
Are you being elected?
Ground floor leafleting, stationery and branded goods, tablecloths and haberdashery, accommodation and food going up. Mobile telephones, focus groups and polling, t-shirts, hoodies, ties, battle busts and posters going up. Outdoor flag. flash mobs, messenger bot services, pest control and emergency chair removal. Party political broadcasts going down.
Yeah, that's just some of the things that political parties spend their money on during election campaigns. Now, the spending limit for parties at elections has recently been increased. They'll now be able to spend more than ever before. The new limit of around £35 million, a significant increase in the previous cap, which was just under £20 million. But what will all that extra money be spent on? Answering that question is not straightforward. We won't know for sure until after the elections take place. But we can look at what they've spent money on in the past. Kate Dommett is a professor of digital politics at the University of Sheffield, who's been researching exactly this and joins me now. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Matt. Great to see you.
No, it's good to have you back with us. So explain what you've done then. Just how many bits of election spending have you been going through?
Oh, well, you know, academics like to take on good tasks. So we looked at 5,770 invoices that were returned after the last general election by political parties.
And how many different items of spending did you then have to try and sort of categorise?
Yeah, quite a lot. So we looked at every invoice to try and work out actually what's going on. So at the moment, when parties kind of declare their spending to the Electoral Commission, it goes under kind of one of 10 headings, and they're really broad. And it's really hard to kind of work out actually what's being spent. So we looked within each invoice and then kind of tried to recode exactly what that money was being spent on. So sometimes it's relatively straightforward. There would just be one item of spending within a single invoice. But at other times, you'd have multiple different lines of expenditure, which we were coding in different ways. And by doing that, we've been able to build up a kind of unprecedented picture of exactly what money is being spent on in the election.
And you've classified them into what you call four eras of campaign activity. And we'll pick our way through them in a moment. But just give us a sense of what they are and how you've taken all of these sort of disparate things and tried to group them, put them into four groups.
Yeah. So as academics, we've kind of tried to understand how campaigning practice has evolved. And we've used this sense of four different eras. So most of the kind of media coverage of elections recently is focused on this kind of most recent fourth era. So that's the idea of like social media advertising, of data analytics, of kind of quite advanced message testing. And I think most people kind of tend to assume that a lot of money goes on those activities, and that's the most prominent area in which parties are spending. But we know that parties do a lot of things that they've been doing for years. So the four eras kind of tries to capture that, and it traces how campaigns evolved. So first era is kind of looking back to the 1950s. You've got, you know, leaflets, door knocking, public rallies, all those really, really traditional activities. Second era kind of accounts for rise of newspapers like TV, polling practices kind of come in. Then third era is like email, websites, phone banking. And then, as I mentioned, that fourth era is kind of social media.
And so let's pick through some of those actually with some people who've been there and done that with political parties. We're joined by Giles Kenningham, former Director of Communications of the Conservative Party. Hi, Giles.
Hey, Matt.
We've got India Thorogood, who led the Labour Party's membership mobilisation efforts during the 2019 election campaign. Hi, India.
Hi there.
And Mark Pack, President of the Lib Dems, who's run various digital and data operations for the Lib Dems over the years. Hi, Mark.
Morning, Matt.
So let's start then, Kate, with what you call the first era, old-fashioned leaflet printing, events, posters, the sort of 1950s approach. How much of the spending goes on the old-fashioned stuff?
Yeah, so kind of around 26% of spending goes on old-fashioned stuff, and it tends to be, you know, really leaflet printing. So the stuff we kind of get through our door every election, that's still a really staple activity.
And let's start with you, first of all, Mark, with the Lib Dems. How important is printing leaflets and stuffing them through letterboxes in 2024?
Absolutely essential. And I think if somebody was from the 1950s and transplanted to a modern election campaign, some things they would find really baffling, like the existence of smartphones. And you have this thing that you can talk to people on that has no cables and so on. But the core of what we do in terms of delivering leaflets through letterboxes and knocking on people's doors absolutely would be very, very recognisable to somebody from 50 years ago. And partly because it's just the best way of reaching voters. You know, to send somebody an email, you have to get permission for their email address. To get to somebody on social media, you have to be able to target them effectively. And these days, I often have to pay up for advertising. Every letterbox, just about, you can find, and it's legal to put a piece of paper through it. And that makes it still a massively powerful campaign tool.
And then the difference between the putting the leaflet through the letterbox and the door, knocking on the door to put the leaflet in the hand of someone, what's the sort of multiple in terms of the effectiveness of that, do you think, Mark?
Well, certainly if you do something like a survey asking people, are there any potholes nearby that you might like to let us know about that we can try and get the council to fix? Typically, you'll get three or four times as many responses if you've actually spoken to the person on the doorstep, in my experience, compared to if you just, you know, leave the leaflet through the letterbox. But also there's a much more important but hard to quantify effect of actually people generally are quite impressed, I think, in my experience, and I'm sure in India and Giles is as well, if someone for a political party turns up on their doorstep. You get the occasional person who really hates, you know, all politicians or your party, but there is actually quite a good long-term positive impression that you leave from turning up once, being friendly, closing the garden gate on the way out and so on.
And so, yeah, India, your job in the last election was mobilising the members, because obviously you need the reason why social media is better, because one person can come up with an advert and then, you know, spread it online. In order to put leaflets through doors or knock on doors, you need a lot of people, and you need to make sure they're in the right place knocking on the right doors.
Yeah, 100%. We know that research shows that actually personal conversations are the most persuasive thing. And actually being told by someone that looks like you, that sounds like you, to vote a certain way is super persuasive and much more persuasive than a leaflet, for example. But look, I think the main things that are persuasive of each election remain the same, which is, you know, good messages, good policies. And these are really important on leaflets, but are much more persuasive on one-to-one conversations. And I think in the last general election campaign, the thing that we had as the Labour Party was ordinary people on our side. And although we weren't successful, one thing we did manage to do was get tens of thousands of people out on the streets. And I think that is really the positive of the Labour Party and the trade union movement.
And I suppose it's all about sometimes, particularly like going back to 2017, seeing some of those rallies and things that Jeremy Corbyn was doing and the big numbers, you sort of create a sense of momentum. But it's quite an old-fashioned thing, the sort of an overflowing public meeting. Giles, from your time when you were the Conservatives, how important was the leaflets to what you were doing?
Yeah, I think like leaflets and direct mail actually was quite important, especially with an older demographic who aren't that plugged in online. And actually, ironically, you know, people get less letters these days because obviously everything's done electronically. So you can have more of an impact. We found ironically posters, although, because, you know, there was a school of thought that posters were quite sort of passe yesterday's sort of era. Obviously, there was that quite famous poster of Ed Miliband and Alex Salmond's pocket, which, you know, reinforced an overall message, but was incredibly effective because it got replayed on TV, in the papers again and again. So yeah, definitely still a place for also even some of the advertising at bus shelters, undergrounds, we have kind of a captive audience. There is still a place for that.
And Kate, that comes into the second era, doesn't it? Are we drifting into the second era now?
Yeah, so the kind of second era is kind of thinking about things like, you know, newspaper advertising, but also particularly what we see coming in this space is like research, so polling, kind of focus groups, that kind of work as well. And we particularly see, you know, most of the major political parties, like this is the category that they actually spend the most of their money under still.
And why is that so important, Giles? That spending money on the research, I suppose, ultimately will decide what you end up putting in your leaflets.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can get the message, so you can do the micro-targeting. And as ever, in these focus groups, it's always the unprompted things, which are really the interesting observations. It's not, you know, you can always ask a question to get the answer you want. But I think in 2014, when we realised that the SNP kind of Labour coalition was a real sort of sticking point, was we did a focus group in Milton Keynes after the referendum, and it came up unprompted by someone saying, oh, yeah, well, the SNP, they're going to take all our money, aren't they? And then we were like, bingo. That was kind of one of those light bulb moments, actually, after the sort of Scottish referendum, it had really cut through. And then it just got reinforced because it just kept coming up on the doorstep again and again, and also unprompted. So, yeah, really important.
And Mark, from the perspective of the Lib Dems, I mean, I know you're a massive, you know, more about politics than probably anyone else. You've really written a terrific book on it. But you don't have the same amount of money to spend on things like polling. Is that a priority for a smaller party like the Lib Dems?
Yeah, I think maybe even more so for a smaller party, because with a smaller party, there's a greater risk that you are not the same as the public as a whole. And, you know, and you see this, you know, every month when you do the Times focus group, when you've got, you know, listeners to Times Radio texting in saying, who on earth are these mad, strange, ignorant people? And the answer is actually, no, that's ordinary members of the public. And so research is really important as a safeguard against thinking that what you're like and what your colleagues in your political party are like is typical of the wider public. The wider public, you know, do play a bit of interest in elections. You know, most people do vote come election time and so on. But overwhelmingly, most members of the public know very, very little about politics compared to even the newest political party member. And that massively influences what's effective to say, how best to campaign and so on.
And when it's reported in the papers, I mean, it happens all the time at the moment, when Downing Street sources say their private polling tells a different story. It's literally impossible for private polling to tell a different story to public polling.
Yeah, private polls are doing exactly the same thing as public polls, except that they don't have that public scrutiny. And therefore, you know, if you're a slightly dodgy pollster or a slightly dodgy political advisor or somebody who's just a bit desperate, you can misread or mislead with the information from private polls in a way that's much harder to do with public polls. My favourite example from a few years back about private polling being given an undue mystique was when there was an excellent Tim Shipman piece, but all about how Boris Johnson had been given private polling on what was happening in the US presidential election. And you just think, there are hundreds and hundreds of public polls. You just could look at the page on Wikipedia and be as well informed as the private polling briefing would tell you.
But I suppose polling, India, can only do so much. In 2019, it was definitely the case that lots of the individual policies put forward by Jeremy Corbyn were incredibly popular. They had big support. But there was somehow there were almost too ambitious. There were too many of them that people were sceptical about the ability to deliver them. So just taking a whole load of things that poll well and putting them all together in one bucket, there's risks to that too.
Yeah, and I think also the risk with polling is that everyone will interpret it in a different way. You know, polling obviously in the 2017 election showed us that there was going to be very different results than potentially there was going to be. And I think the thing with data is that, you know, I came of age very much in a data-driven era of campaigning, but you can interpret these things in very different ways. And I think that happens a lot of time behind the scenes in political parties, is these debates about what this means or what that means. And I think ultimately we try to be data-driven, but often we're looking at data in a very different way. And I think that's often the case in election campaigns.
Yes, yeah, people using data to say, well, actually, I think you'll find I'm right, rather than starting with what is the data telling us. Let's move on now to the third era. Professor Kate Dommett, what sort of spending sits in the third era?
Yeah, so this was like surprisingly low, actually. So it was only 5.4% of spending kind of came in this bucket. So this kind of accounts for stuff like consultancy, so you see political parties kind of bring in big external firms, but also things like IT infrastructure, you know, kind of building websites, building kind of email operations. But it is much less prominent than the other areas for all the parties.
And yet, is the sort of stuff, oh, we've brought in some outside experts, you know, or we've got a new whiz-bang website and that sort of thing, that gets talked up a lot. But it's a bit sort of 90s noughties, I suppose. I imagine that the sort of this sounds like very New Labour type stuff. But it's the stuff that gets talked about in the sort of analysis pieces without actually making up that big a slice of what parties are doing.
Yeah, it's kind of like the back office stuff, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of the infrastructure that is important, but, you know, in some ways. So these spending returns cover the election period. They don't cover kind of what parties spend outside of that period. So it might be that a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, so, you know, kind of setting up your IT infrastructure, money's being spent outside an election. So in some ways...
You've got your website and your platforms and all that signed up. So go on then, what's in what you call the fourth era, which the turning point for that is what, like 2008?
So kind of a little bit later than that. It's kind of a bit more recent. So it's kind of when we start seeing social media come on board.
Okay.
So, a bit more kind of around 2015 and since then. So the big thing in this era is like Facebook advertising, which we've seen, you know, significant amounts of money spent on, which is quite a new feature, obviously, for political parties to exploit. But also we kind of see the data analytics work, kind of A-B testing online to be able to optimize different features on party websites or fundraising emails, that kind of thing. So it's the real data analytics era.
And yeah, and then I suppose that's when it all gets people. We've got, you know, great data and we're analysing the data and it's all going to be ultra micro targeting and all of that. India, Thorogood, from your time with the Labour Party on the last election, I suppose you have to sort of separate what you're broadcasting on social media from believing what you're seeing on social media in that sense of, well, everyone I'm following on Twitter says they're going to vote Labour. We're going to win by a landslide.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to break outside of the bubble. That's the very nature of election campaigning. But I mean, in terms of this era of campaigning, I think this is something that Labour actually focuses on a lot, because obviously at the time of me working for the Labour Party, we had 550,000 members we wanted to communicate with. So we needed a database, we needed to send emails. And we did a lot of kind of A-B testing on these emails.
Just explain what that means, India, A-B testing.
Yeah, so basically you get one version of an email, but we test it against kind of three or four other different versions of an email, which might have a different subject line or different content in it. And that allows us to test what raises the most money and what gets the most people volunteering. And so in the last general election campaign, the team that I ran, we raised £5.1 million from small donations. The average donation was £20, which is good, clean money, and allowed us to actually go out there and campaign for ordinary people. So it was that testing, that kind of digital era of stuff that kind of came about after Barack Obama, really, campaign in America. A lot of us over here were inspired by what he did in the States. And, you know, just using email and a lot of the digital tools at our disposal to kind of mobilise people, but also to persuade a little bit as well.
And Giles Cunningham, how important was that sort of stuff to the Conservatives, who bluntly get very rich people to write very large cheques?
I think it's still important for raising small amounts of cash, absolutely. And yeah, especially amongst trying to target a younger generation, absolutely has its place, yeah.
And for you, Mark Pack, when the Lib Dems are trying to raise money, again, is that trying to get it from smaller donations, using the emails and things like you were saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Smaller donations are a really important part of politics. And actually, that's one thing that's become a lot easier with the rise of the internet and us all getting used to making payments online. Now, even if somebody, say, saw a political speech and they were really impressed by it, it used to take weeks and weeks for the money to come in, because you'd have to, but, you know, write a check, post the check off, bank the check, etc. Now you can see that surge happen, you know, immediately, within seconds. And unfortunately, my party has made a bit of a speciality out of having surges of money and donations off the back of really unsuccessful events. I'm not quite sure what it is about us failing spectacularly, like in the 2015 election campaign, that has people rushing to give us money. But you saw, you know, within minutes of Nick Clegg's very moving
sympathy money,
speech in 2015. Exactly.
Well, I mean, you take it where you can get it, I suppose, is the other thing. So finally, then, I want to look ahead to the next election. Where would you think that people should be spending their money, Kate?
Yeah, so I think we'll see a lot more spent on online. So we'll see kind of metering, like geographically targeted ads placed through Google and kind of YouTube pre-roll videos. I think we'll see quite a lot of that. But we will still see a lot spent on, like, probably paid leaflet delivery. You know, parties are really struggling for activists who are willing to post these things for free. So, you know, we've seen particularly Lib Dems require an awful lot on having to pay for leaflets to be delivered. So I imagine we'll see as much of that as we will as of spending online.
Finally, then, I want to ask you all, what's the weirdest thing you've wasted your money on? Kate, you've picked out some great examples from 2019.
Oh, we have found some absolutely amazing ones. So I loved the £1,400 the Lib Dems spent on puppet making. My favourite one is the SNP, who spent just over £5,000 on stress rocking eggs. No idea what that is.
Stress rocking eggs?
God knows. Yeah.
I'm not even sure that's safe to Google.
And the Brexit also spent £25,000 on a flash mob.
The Brexit party?
Yeah.
That seems like a lot for a flash mob. Isn't the whole point that people are supposed to source of volunteers to? Giles, your favourite waste of money at the Tory party?
I don't know if it's waste of money. Probably the most effective thing we did, which is probably quite cheesy, is we had bottles of brown ale and Gordon Brown bottled corn election in 2007, which, although it seemed quite sort of, I suppose, basic and crude, it made like the main news bulletins. The thing I reckon we wasted the money on the most amount was giving journalists like you these survival kits at conference from the run up to the elections, which is full of Barocca and aspirins and all this kind of stuff to try and buy your goodwill. But I don't think it ever got us anywhere.
No, we did like having them. It just didn't make any difference to our...
exactly. Our,
if anything, we were probably ruder about you just to show that we weren't being bought. India, what did the Labour Party waste money on?
Hey, look, we don't waste money. Our money is from ordinary workers across the country. So I'd love to give you a hilarious answer, but, you know, I've never wasted the money of people across the UK.
The
Labour Party should spend money on therapy for its staff. I like the idea of the eggs. That sounds like a good use of money. But yeah, we don't. I wouldn't have wasted money of good, hardworking people. You can waste those super rich donors' money, Charles. That's absolutely good for you, but it's not for the party of the workers.
No, I think, frankly, all parties should be given journalists Barocca. Mark, can you explain what the puppets were from the 2019 election?
I'm trying to remember. I do remember we had puppets in the 1992 and 97 general election, which worked really well, which was talking about the politics between Labour and Tories being the Punch and Judy show. So those puppets were very, very good, successful. Given our 2019 election result, whatever the puppets were, they were not in the 92-97 class.
And will you be spending more money on silly stunts, egg timers and clocks and
doors? Oh, don't you worry, Matt. There are loads more cheesy Lipton photo stunts to come with exciting props.
Good. Well, I look forward to that because they make for great radio, if nothing else. Mark, really good to speak to you. Mark Pack there, president of the Lib Dems. India Thorogood, who led the Labour Party's membership mobilisation efforts during the 2019 election campaign. Giles Kenningham was a former director of communications of the Conservative Party. And Kate Domitt is the one who did all was involved in all this research, professor of digital politics at the University of Sheffield. Thanks very much for joining us today on Politics Without the Boring Bits. If you just tuned in, you can catch up on all of that on the Politics Without the Boring Bits podcast a bit later on as well. So many of you have been getting in touch with things that you've wasted money on. So we'll do some of those. 0333 003 2353. What have you wasted your money on? Helen's been in touch. Said the Edstone was a waste of money for Labour. I don't think you find it was, Helen. I've been dining out on it ever since. In fact, you can read about the Edstone in my book, Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors, which is definitely not a waste of money. Lovely bit of Are You Being Served on a Friday. And if you want to get in touch, email me, matt@times.radio. WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.